What I'm talking about today, in conclusion, is the legacy of David. And I thought, in order to kind of get us thinking about legacy, this is the tombstone of Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson is buried at Monticello in Charlottesville. Rosemary and I spent a year there during my training in Charlottesville. And when you lived in Charlottesville, you could go up to Monticello without any charge. So we went up there on several occasions, and this is his tombstone there where he's buried. He wanted to be remembered by three things. One was his contribution to the Declaration of Independence. Then his role in the statutes of Virginia, which had to do with religious freedom, and the building of the University of Virginia there in Charlottesville. And it said that he could look through his telescope out his window. This is a little small mountains, Monticello. And he could look down on the city or on the town of Charlottesville at that time and watch the construction and see how they were doing it. Y'all are all familiar with the dome there at the University of Virginia and the serpentine walls. You've never been there. There are unique walls around the campus there that Thomas Jefferson was responsible for. So this is what he wanted to be remembered by. Just a side note, it seems like this is Patriotic Sunday, isn't it? As a side note, he didn't want his tombstone made out of marble or granite. He wanted it made out of sandstone or some cheap rock because he was afraid that people would steal his tombstone and use it in construction. But unfortunately, because it was a cheap, easily fractured rock, people would chip little pieces off of it as souvenirs, and so it became very damaged over the years. And about the turn of the century, from around 1900 or so, they had to create a new tombstone for him, and this time they put a large wrought iron fence around the gravesite to keep people out so they wouldn't do this. But this is a part of the legacy of Thomas Jefferson. So when I think of Thomas Jefferson, I think of these two things at least, the Declaration of Independence and University of Virginia. I don't usually think about the Bill of Rights of Virginia with religious freedom, but that was what he wanted to be remembered by. It brings up the question then, what is legacy? And we're talking about David's legacy today. So, first of all, what is a legacy?
What you leave behind.
Something that a person leaves behind. So, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's something that is left by an ancestor to a descendant, usually. So, this is Thomas Jefferson's legacy. He left the University of Virginia, for example, to the people of Virginia. What was David's legacy? We've had a bunch of lessons about David over the past couple of years. So what are the things that come to mind that makes you remember David? What was David's legacy to us?
Psalms.
All right, that's good. He left a lot of the Psalms.
Lineage of Jesus.
He's the lineage of Jesus. A man after God's own heart.
Sweet singer of Israel.
I'm sorry?
Sweet singer of Israel.
All right.
Psalm 51, what repentance is.
All right, so all the Psalms.
Love the Lord.
You love the Lord. This is a Christian group, so y'all have got it down. But what might a secular group think of David? Or perhaps a Jew might think of David.
King.
What was their legacy? They would think about his kingship. They would think about the golden age of Israel. Israel was a powerful nation in those days. Had a standing army.
Jerusalem is the capital.
Jerusalem is the capital. We had a lesson on that, how he conquered Jerusalem, made it his capital.
Songs of Solomon.
Songs of Solomon. real hero for children. What are some of the negative things about his legacy you remember?
Bathsheba.
All right. Bathsheba. So, you know, you can leave a legacy, it can be either positive or negative. When you think about your legacy or my legacy, you think about a businessman, for example. He starts a business and he builds it from the ground up and he expands it, makes it a very productive business. And so his legacy might be to leave that business to his son. And then his son leaves it to his son, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We're in an academic environment here in Chapel Hill. So at the university, your legacy might be that you receive some award, maybe as a teacher of the year. Or if you're a researcher, you might discover some new cure for a particular kind of a cancer or make some achievement in research, or you publish a book, or you present papers at a national meeting that are recognized as sentinel papers in your particular discipline. We've had, over the years, we've had several people nominated for Nobel Prizes, and in fact, we've had some Nobel Prize winners in the area for chemistry and medicine. So that might be a legacy as far as its application to us. We pick up the story of David today at a point in his life when he's probably around 60 years old. You'll remember that his reign lasted 40 years, and so he's been king now for about 30 years, and things have, he's expanded the kingdom. It's 60,000 square miles. It extends all the way up to the Tigris and Euphrates River, modern day Iraq that we talk about today. It included the Sinai Peninsula down to Egypt in the south. He had a standing army, second to none in the area. A lot of the nations paid tribute to Israel at the time. There's peace in the land. He's won all his battles. He's defeated the Philistines. He's defeated everybody around him. They all respect him. This is, like I said, the golden age of Israel. I mean, he's probably around 60. So plans are all falling into place now to leave this very successful kingdom to his son. But then plans go wrong. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Just to give you a timeline, refresh your memory over all these lessons that we've had over the past 2 years. You'll recall that David was anointed by Samuel to be king of Israel. Saul was the first king. God decided he was not fit to be king, so he had Samuel anoint David to be king. David was probably around 15, 16 years old at the time. He was a shepherd boy. In fact, all his brothers had been brought before Samuel, and David was still out caring for the sheep. He was anointed. He went back out to care for the sheep. And then the next time we find him, he's fighting Goliath, defeats Goliath. And then he's brought into Saul's court because of his music abilities to soothe Saul's spirit because he was troubled. Then he becomes a warrior and a captain in Saul's army and becomes very successful in defeating the enemy and becomes even more popular than Saul, the king. As a result, Saul becomes jealous. David becomes a fugitive. And then for the next 12 to 13 years, he's out in the wilderness with a small band of followers. He even spends some time with the Philistines trying to escape from Saul, who's out to try and kill him. Saul and Jonathan finally die in a battle with the Philistines, and then David becomes king. But it's not smooth going at first, because there's still followers of Saul around. There's some of his family. And so there's basically a civil war for about 7.5 years. It's not a unified kingdom. It's only the tribe of Judah that David is king of during that period of time. But he finally defeats Saul's followers. He then brings all 12 tribes together into a united kingdom. He captures Jerusalem. We had a lesson on that. He brings the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle into Jerusalem to solidify Jerusalem as the capital of the nation. Then builds the nation up over these past 30 years to where we end today. And as I said, plans seem to be going well, but then they fall flat on their face. His dream, his plans for the nation are interrupted, and he fails. It brings up an interesting question for us. Have we ever had a point in our life when our dreams, our plans that we have made don't work out? Maybe you had plans to advance in your job, but you didn't get that promotion. Or you had a dream for your children, and they didn't turn out the way you wanted them to. Or in the case of some of us, your grandchildren. And you don't like the way your children are raising your grandchildren, you know? They're just not doing it right. Now, if I was doing it, this is what I would do for those children. But we've all had instances like that. I had an instance like that when I started work here. Came here in 1973. I was recruited as a researcher. After my residency in surgery, I spent a year in Gainesville, Florida, doing research in the medicine department of all places. I guess I've still got a little flea in me. But I did research. Internists are called fleas.
We jump on anything and just gnaw it to death.
That's right. Or the surgical side of that is the flea is the last thing to leave a dead body. We won't go there anymore. But anyhow, I was recruited here as a researcher, and I'd done research in gastrointestinal endocrinology. Gastrin was a hormone produced by the gut. It was a very popular, hot topic at that time. And so I learned radioimmunoassay, which was a very precise, detailed technique of measurement of infinitesimally small amounts of hormone in the blood system. And to give you an example of how small it could be, I calculated it out once, and if you took a tablespoon of dye and put it in University Lake, down south of town here, took a glass of water out of that lake, you could still measure the dye in that glass of water. So this was in picogram amounts, 10 to the minus 12. So this is a very, very detailed kind of study. Well, I was recruited as a researcher, so I came here, I set up a lab. It was going pretty well. I had established radioimmunoassay techniques to measure gastrin here. The lab at the hospital wanted me to do them for the hospital. And I had published a couple of papers and presented at a couple of meetings. But I was not happy. I did this for about a year and a half, and I realized that although this was my dream, this was my plan, it was not working out. I was not happy because I enjoyed patient contact. I enjoyed teaching residents. I enjoyed operating in the operating room, and I didn't get much out of dealing with rabbits and mice all day long. So I was very disappointed in myself. I was discouraged. You might even say depressed. And I was very apprehensive because I thought, well, I might lose my job because after all, I was recruited here to be a researcher, and you know, I'm not turning out the way they wanted. But fortunately, my chairman allowed me to shift my focus into clinical research and teaching and whatnot. So I remained here and retired a few years later. But that was an example of my plans and dreams not being fulfilled and being very disappointed. It just didn't work out. And that's where we find David today. We have to go back a little bit because it begins with David and Bathsheba. And you'll remember that Nathan, the prophet at that time, told David that there would be turmoil in his household because of his sin. And now that's come home to roost. David's firstborn son, Amnon, lusts after his half-sister Tamar. And he rapes her and shames her. Tamar's brother, the second in line for the throne, Absalom, is infuriated, and he kills Amnon. And now Absalom leaves the city of Jerusalem. He flees for his life because he's afraid his father might kill him for what he did. And he goes into exile for 3 years. Finally, Joab, David's general, encourages David to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. And so David does. He allows him to come home back to Jerusalem. But they remain estranged. David and Absalom have nothing to do with each other. And this goes on for several years, during which time Absalom begins to win the people over to himself and away from David. He tells the people, "I can be a better king than my father." And he listens to the people, and he sits at the gate and hears their complaints. And David's off up in the palace somewhere, removed from the people. And so after about 4 or 5 years, Absalom now has gathered together an army from all the tribes of Israel, except from Judah, and is now marching on Jerusalem to take over the city by force. And so at this point in time, we find that David is now fleeing for his life from Jerusalem with a contingency of guard and some Judahites who follow him. And he's fleeing for his life. His plans have not worked out. He thought that things were going to be coasting downhill from here on out until he could turn his kingdom over to his second son in line, which would have been Absalom. But Absalom has preempted that. And has created the civil war. So that's where we pick up today. And I think that that's where we can see some examples of David's legacy, which is not material as much as a lot of people think a legacy should be, but it's more a spiritual legacy. And that's the point I will make today with this lesson. So let's pick up here, and I've asked Sandra if she would read this for us.
2 Samuel 15:23-26. The whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the wilderness. Zadok was there too, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. They set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar offered sacrifices until all the people had finished leaving the city.
All right. Let's stop right there. Zadok and Abiathar were Levitical priests, and they were the ones that were supposed to carry the ark, care for the ark, and make the sacrifices when those were appropriate. So they gone down out the eastern gate to the Temple Mount, which was, of course, much smaller in those days than what we think of when we think of Herod's Temple. That was 1,000 years later. So it's a much smaller Temple Mount. And that's, of course, where Solomon is later going to build the temple. But it's only the tabernacle that's there right now. And it contained the Ark of the Covenant. And so they're leaving the city with the Ark of the Covenant, and they've gone down to the Kidron Valley, which at that time was just a valley of pasture. Today, it's a huge graveyard, and they make a sacrifice to God. Now, we need to kind of refresh our memory on what the Ark of the Covenant is. It's a box. It's a box that Moses and Aaron made on Sinai when Moses was given the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone. And this ark contains those tablets. There's one reference in Scripture which says it also contained the rod of Aaron and a bowl of manna that the Israelites had received on their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. But we know for sure it contained at least the tablets with the Ten Commandments on it. It was a box that was covered by gold, both inside and out. The poles on either side is what the box was carried by. You could not touch the box or you would die. And remember the lesson we had there where Uzzah touched the box and to keep it from falling off the cart, and he was struck dead immediately. And he was not a Levite who was the one supposed to care for the box. And then the box is covered by this, the top here called the mercy seat, which was the metaphorical seat where God sat between these two cherubim, these two angels. It implied the presence of God, the power of God, the protection of God, the blessings of God. You recall it when Joshua conquered Jericho, they carried the ark around the city walls 7 times before the walls fell down. Whenever they went to battle with the Philistines, they would carry this box because God was present with Israel and would help them and allow them to win the battle. However, on one occasion, the Philistines captured it, remember? And when they did, they were cursed. They broke out in sores all over. Their God was toppled from the platform and fell and broke. And they were just having all sorts of problems. So they put it on a cart and sent it back to Israel. They didn't want it because they were cursed because they had the box and weren't supposed to have it. David put the ark in a man's house until he could bring it to Jerusalem. This man had no children, yet his wife got pregnant during that period of time. So he was blessed in the eyes of the people. His crops flourished. So because he was caring for the ark in his house, he was blessed by God. So let's now see let me deviate one more time. I've got to bring a little archaeology into this. This is a picture of the pinnacle of Mount Moriah from within the Dome of the Rock Shrine. So you're looking down upon the pinnacle of Mount Moriah. Now, what's the significance of Mount Moriah?
It's supposedly where Abraham took Isaac.
All right. Scripture tells us that's where Abraham took Isaac to sacrifice. In Islam, it was Ishmael. In Islam, scripture in the Quran. Any other significance about the pinnacle of Mount Moriah?
The temple was built over the rock,
and in fact, it was the Holy of Holies that was over the rock. And if you kind of look at this white area, kind of a square-looking area on it, kind of at 4 o'clock position on the picture there, that's where scholars think the Ark of the Covenant sat. It's a flattened area. It was chiseled out on the top of the pinnacle, and it's a flat area. I don't have a side view of it, but it's a flat area, and it fits the size of the Ark. The Ark was 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubic wide, and 1.5 cubic tall. A cubic being the distance between the tip of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. But it always varied a little bit because it was based usually upon the length of the elbow of the king at that time. So if the king was a small guy, it was less than about 18 inches. If he was a big guy, it was a little bit more than about 18 inches. But roughly about 18 inches in length. So this box was roughly about a little over 4 feet by about 2.5 feet by 2.5 feet in size. We've all seen the Raiders of the Lost Ark, so we all know what it looks like. But this is the pinnacle of Mount Moriah, and this is where the Dome of the Rock is built today, because in Islam, this is the third most holy place in Islam, second to Mecca and Medina, where Muhammad lived. But Muhammad, supposedly by tradition, is supposed to have ascended into heaven from this particular point. It's kind of interesting. Muhammad died in 636 CE. The Quran was written sometimes after his death, probably within the next 30 or 40 years, from just verbal remembrance of what he had said. Nothing that he ever said was written down during his lifetime. It was all done from just remembering an oral memorization of some of his sayings into the Quran. So the Quran went through several editions, you might say, over the next 30 or 40 years. And in Surah, I guess it's 17, I think, he talks about his ascension into heaven, but he never mentions Jerusalem as being that place. And that's kind of by tradition just grown up to be where it's thought that he ascended into heaven, but there's no reference to Jerusalem per se in the Quran. But that's the reason why this shrine was built and why this is the third most holy place in Islam. All right, back to the lesson. That's all the archaeology for today. Okay, so I'll read this one. Then the king said to Zadok, take the Ark of God back into the city. Whoa, this is not what you're supposed to do, David. I mean, after all, the Ark is God's presence. He's your protection. This is where God abides. If you have the Ark, then God is with you. He's going to protect you. He's going to be with you. He's going to bless you. I mean, you're probably going to have a battle with Absalom and his army here in the next few weeks. And you certainly want God on your side, don't you? I mean, you're going to send it back into Jerusalem, and now Absalom's going to have the Ark. And God's going to be on his side, and you're going to get defeated and probably killed. This is counterintuitive. I mean, you don't send the Ark back into Jerusalem, do you? Let's see what David did. Yeah.
If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it in his dwelling place again. But if he says, I am not pleased with you, then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him.
All right. So what basically David is saying, look, here were my plans, here were my dreams, and they're shattered now. Absalom is out to defeat me. He's trying to take the kingdom away from me. And I've just got to turn this over to God. I've done all I can do, and I can't do any more, and I don't know what to do. So I just got to surrender this to God. And whatever happens, whether it be good for me or bad for me, I will abide by what God does. So I think the first lesson that we learn from this particular experience is that God surrenders his dream, that David surrenders his dreams to God. So now David goes on. Let's see what happens next. He's going to leave the Kidron Valley, go up the Mount of Olives as he leaves the city to go out into the wilderness across the Jordan, which will be the west bank today. But that was wilderness in those days. Go ahead.
But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered, and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too, and were weeping as they went up. Now David had been told, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom.
All right. Well, what's the significance of this? Who was Ahithophel?
Granddaddy of the message.
All right. Okay. Lynn, you're very good. You prepared for this lesson. We don't know that he was the father of Bathsheba, There is a, her father's name was Ahithophel.
No, it's her granddaddy.
Was it her granddaddy?
It's her granddaddy.
All right, maybe it was her granddaddy. But either way, some scholars believe that he was the same man. And therefore, if he was, then he was part of David's extended family. He was a part of the family. But the main thing is, he was David's advisor. He had been with David for 30 years, from the very beginning. He had advised David. He was sort of looked upon as a seer, as a prophet. He was wise. His advice had always been good. It allowed David to make good choices in developing the kingdom. And so he had been with David for 30 years as his chief advisor. And in that period of time, he became a close friend with David. In fact, maybe even a mentor to David. So now David finds out that this man, who has been his close advisor, his mentor, his friend, maybe even part of his family, has now gone over to Absalom, his enemy. I think our response would be, well, you've become a traitor to me, you stabbed me in the back, and I'm going to be the very best enemy you can have. I'm going to get back at you. You think you've got problems, you've really got problems now. I would be angry. I mean, that would be our worldly response to that. But let's see what David does.
So David prayed, "Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness."
So instead of cursing Ahithophel, instead of being angry at him, he just asked God to make his advice foolish. As he advises now Absalom to make it foolish, to make it non-profitable advice. This is kind of the short form of the situation. The long form is found in Psalms 55. In Psalms 55, David is thought to have written this by scholars at this particular time. And so I think we can see a little bit better what's going on in David's mind in Psalms 55. So let's look at that.
"Listen to my prayer, O God. Do not ignore my plea. Hear me and answer me. My thoughts trouble me, and I am distraught because of what my enemy is saying, because of the threats of the wicked. For they bring down suffering on me and assail me in their anger. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen on me."
And now he turns his comments toward Ahithophel.
"If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were rising against me, I could hide. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend, with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship at the house of God as we walked about among the worshipers."
So his relationship is broken with his chief advisor, his friend, his companion. And it's not like a stab in the back. I mean, he could handle that. He could run from physical harm. He could hide. He could endure it. It's the stab in the heart that really is hurting David. It's his best friend, his advisor, his family member who's become a traitor to him. And this is what's causing his mental anguish over this. So now he turns back to God, and this is what he says.
"His talk is smooth as butter, yet war is in his heart. His words are more soothing than oil, yet they are drawn swords. But as for me, I trust in you, God."
Okay. So he's saying, you know, I can't change this. I can't help it. All I can do is trust in you, God, that you will see me through this. And so he surrendered his dreams to God. He now surrenders this broken relationship to God. And then there's a one-third example of God's spiritual legacy.
As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you murderer, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has given the kingdom into the hands of your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a murderer.
All right, so here's David. I mean, he's got the, he's mourning. His head is covered. He's barefooted, which are examples illustrating mourning. The people are weeping and mourning with him. And here's this old man. He comes out on a little ridge above him. He's cursing David. He's a member. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. He's a follower of Saul. And he's bringing up things that happened 30 years before. And he's cursing David and calling David a murderer. I mean, you know, what would be your response to that? He's humiliating David. I think we would probably allow pride to get in the way and we would strike back, wouldn't we?
Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head.
All right, so that would have been what you would have thought. David would have said, yep, go do it. Get rid of this guy. I'm tired of listening to him. He's humiliated me, and it's uncalled for.
But the king said, what does this have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who can ask, why do you do this? David then said to Abishai and all his officials, my son, my own flesh and blood, is trying to kill me. How much more than this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore to me his covenant blessing instead of his curse today. So David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going all the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went and throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt.
So this is the third example of David's spiritual legacy. His dreams have been shattered, and so he turns them over to God. A relationship, a very meaningful relationship, has been broken, so he turns it over to God. And now he's being humiliated, and he turns his pride over to God. I think that the legacy of David is illustrated very well with these examples. His dreams and plans, he turns over to God. And, you know, we started out saying, what dreams and plans that you had that have not worked out? Maybe your job has not turned out the way you wanted it. Or maybe your dream for success has not been the way you planned it. And have you turned that over to God? The same thing with relationships. Maybe you're having a relationship problem with your spouse or with somebody at work or with your children. And we just have to turn that over to God like David did. And then I think the hardest one to do, of course, is pride. And when we have our pride injured, do we ever turn that over to God or do we try and deal with it on our own? So, this concludes the stories of David, and that's why we call him a man after God's own heart. Even though David failed many times during his lifetime, he always came back to God. And I think that is the important lesson we need to learn from David. He was a person just like us. We fail from time to time, and when we do, we need to return to God. So, I'm open for questions or comments. Anybody want to comment about David's life? No questions. I must have done a great job or either confused you completely.